Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Francisco Leon, and I represent Leonel Villaseñor in this appeal. I know I only have 10 minutes, so I'd like to focus on two issues, the constructive amendment of the indictment, and the sufficiency of evidence, unless the Court has questions regarding the other two issues.
Very good.
The original indictment in this case, as we pointed out in our briefs, charged a conspiracy from a date unknown until March the 5th. A superseding indictment narrowed the terms of that conspiracy to March 5th. And that was the basis.
On or about March 5th.
On or about March 5th, correct.
About March 5th.
Right. And we proceeded on that basis that we were trying a conspiracy case that began or occurred on or about March 5th of 2003. Shortly before trial, approximately 7 days before trial, the prosecution disclosed that it wanted to bring in evidence of events in November of 2002 and in January of 2003. We objected to that, arguing that that was outside of the scope of the conspiracy that was charged in the indictment. But our objection was overruled by the court, and the court allowed the prosecution to bring in evidence that Mr. Villaseñor had been stopped with a fellow named Daniel Sanchez about 2 months prior to the arrest on March the 5th, and that Mr. Sanchez, sometime in November of 2002, approximately 2 months or 4 months earlier, had apparently rented a warehouse where Mr. Villaseñor was arrested.
So would your position be that given the way the indictment was framed, with a conspiracy, as I understand how the grand jury initially returned it, that occurred on March the 5th, that the government would be limited in its proof to only events that occurred on March 5th? They would not even be allowed to introduce evidence as to who rented the storage locker 2-3 months before?
If the charge is that the conspiracy occurred on or about March the 5th, we submit that the evidence would have been limited to reasonably that evidence which supports a conviction that occurred on or about March the 5th.
So is your answer to my question yes? The
yes.
Government would have been precluded from introducing evidence as to who rented the storage locker?
Correct.
Even though he was still the registered lessor or lessee on March the 5th?
I think that evidence would have been relevant on that date, but what the prosecution attempted to show was that there was a connection between Mr. Villaseñor and Mr. Sanchez, and that the connection was that Mr. Sanchez had rented this warehouse 4 months earlier, and that they had been together in January of 2003, and thus this showed a conspiracy.
But on a conspiracy theory, isn't each day relevant? So that if they were conspiring together on or about March 5th, that it might be relevant to show that this conspiracy had begun much earlier and was a continuing conspiracy.
Well, there's certainly some relevancy to that, but there's certainly limits to relevancy as well. I mean, if you want to go back 4 or 5 months or even 4 or 5 years to show that they had a knowledge of each other, that they knew each other, then I think you run into the objection that evidence may be irrelevant because you don't know what the facts or circumstances are that they were together or how it is that they knew each other. The issue here is whether or not they were conspiring to possess with an intent to distribute on or about March the 5th. There's no evidence at all that in November of 2002, when Mr. Sanchez rented this warehouse, that they were together, that they knew each other, that they associated with each other. And even the evidence of January of 2003, they were simply in a vehicle together that was being driven by Mr. Villaseñor. Aside from that, you know, the obvious objection is, what relevance is that other than to show that they know each other or had been in a vehicle together?
But why isn't that always relevant in a conspiracy charge when the nature of the crime, the elements require proof of an agreement between at least two people to engage in a criminal act? Doesn't that put the defendant on notice that he's going to have to face proof at trial that there's somebody else that he conspired with?
Well, and that brings me to the second point of whether or not that is sufficient evidence to show a conspiracy. Let's assume and we concede that they were in the same vehicle in January of 2003. How does that show a conspiracy? We know practically nothing about the circumstances of January of 2003 other than that they were stopped for speeding, and that Mr. Villaseñor and Mr. Sanchez were together along with Mario Jacobo and his son and an elderly gentleman. And so, again, we come back to how is that relevant to show that they are engaged in a conspiracy other than that they know each other. The mere fact that people know each other, we submit to the court, without more, doesn't prove a conspiracy on or about March the 5th of 2003 as is charged in the superseding indictment.
Well, it might if the proof shows a sufficient enough of a relationship between the owner of the leased premises and your client, who was found on the premises on March the 5th, wouldn't it?
Well, but there was no such evidence shown, is the point.
But that really goes, as you indicate, to the weight or the sufficiency of the evidence. And in your variance argument, I think, maybe I've got this analyzed incorrectly, your variance argument really goes to a challenge to the elements of the offense and surprise that the defendant claims to have suffered to his prejudice by not being earlier put on notice by a broader indictment that would tell him that he would have to face evidence of prior associations before March the 5th?
Well, the indictment charged that Mr. Villaseñor and Mr. Pesqueda conspired with each other and other unknown persons. And we're not arguing that there is a variance here. If it were a mere variance, we'd probably lose on that. What we're arguing is that the prosecution brings in its evidence and then asks the court, by jury instruction, amend the indictment. Instead of charging on or about March the 5th, now say from a time unknown, so that it will include what evidence the prosecution now has brought in. And that is what we're submitting, is not a mere variance. That is a constructive amendment of the indictment, which is...
But Ninth Circuit case law has always recognized, and we routinely tell juries in virtually every case, that you need not find that the events occurred exactly on the date charged in the indictment. And I'm having a hard time understanding why what the district court did here was not in conformance with well-settled Ninth Circuit law.
Well, as I say, I think there's a difference, and maybe it's just a matter of degree, between variance and constructive amendment of the indictment.
Well, isn't the difference that if the element of the crime is not laid in the indictment, then it's a constructive indictment. But the date is not an element of the crime, is it, here?
Well, we submit that it is, Your Honor, because the conspiracy has to have occurred on or about March the 5th. That's what the indictment charges.
Your position, if it doesn't occur on March the 5th, then it's a constructive amendment of the indictment, and March the 5th is an essential element of the crime of conspiracy.
Well, on or about March the 5th, because as you may have noticed, in fact, the superseding indictment charged March the 4th, and without objection from us, the prosecution asked the court to correct the indictment because it was a typographical error. But yes, we had notice certainly of what was happening on March the 5th, and we had that notice up until the day before trial when the prosecution discloses all this evidence about what happened in November of 2002 and in January of 2003. And now they're saying that that's part of the conspiracy. And they're also saying that Daniel Sanchez, the person who had rented this place back in November of 2002, was an unindicted co-conspirator for the first time the day before trial. That materially changes the indictment we submit and puts Mr.
In the case of the typical charging language that names some of the members of the conspiracy and then says, and others unknown to the grand jury?
Well, here's the problem with that, I think, and that is that such disclosure, if it's made early on in the case, at least allows the defendant to be able to know what he's going to be facing. Here on the day before trial, the prosecution reveals for the first time that Daniel Sanchez is an unindicted co-conspirator, according to their theory, and that now we have to defend against that association or that knowledge.
Did you file a motion for a bill of particulars asking the United States to identify the names of unindicted co-conspirators?
No, we knew pretty much that on or about March the 5th it was Hector Pesqueda and Mr. Villaseñor and unknown persons.
So is the complaint then really almost a sort of a Jinx Act complaint that, we didn't get our discovery until just before trial?
Well, under the Jenks Act, they're not even required to disclose statements until after the witness has testified. In the District of Arizona, there's a practice where we waive the preliminary hearing in exchange for early Jenks Act disclosure. Early Jenks Act disclosure, we submit, ought to be at least longer or earlier than the day before trial.
The problem is that's an argument you got to make to Congress. We don't have the power to tell them to rewrite Section 3500.
And I realize that. But that's why I say that that our best argument, I think, is that this materially constructively amended the indictment from what we should have been facing to what it is that the prosecution decided the day before.
When you learned that the government was going to use Mr. Sanchez as one of the unindicted co-conspirators, that was the day before trial?
Yes.
Did you make a motion to continue the trial?
No. My client had been in custody since March the 5th. We were early part of December, and we were prepared to go to trial. We wanted to go to trial.
You weren't prepared to go to trial as against the evidence of Sanchez in November and January 2003.
We weren't prepared in the sense that material had not been disclosed to us.
But you were prepared to go to trial
with what had been disclosed.
And when you learned about Sanchez, you didn't make a motion to continue on the grounds that you needed more time to investigate the new circumstances.
No.
Do you want to save some time? You're out of time.
Yes, I'm sorry.
All right, great. We'll hear from Mr. You're going to have to help me with the pronunciation. Is it?
For the United States, Judson Myhock.
Myhock.
Oh. Myhock.
Thank you.
On or about March 5th, 2003, certainly put the defendant on notice that the indictment pertaining to the conspiracy charge, we weren't going to be constricted or restricted to acts which just occurred on March 5th, 2003.
Why did you charge it that way? I mean, doesn't the form book say beginning at a time unknown but continuing until on or about March 5, 2003?
And touching on what Mr. Leone said, it was a typographical error. The original complaint, which was initiated the action, charged from a time unknown to on or about March 5th, 2003. The original indictment handed up April 2nd, 2003, charged from a time unknown to on or about March 5th, 2003. The superseding indictment, which was handed up in June, and I've included the minutes from the grand jury with regard to that superseding indictment, the only effect of the superseding indictment was to add a count 3 with respect to the co-defendant, which was a charge of illegal reentry. The first two counts, there was no proof even put in whatsoever. And it was my oversight that there was a typographical error.
How can it be a typographical error to omit the words from time unknown? So you're saying in the superseding indictment, you left out the words from a time unknown and just said on or about March 5th?
Actually, the first superseding indictment charge stated on or about March 4th, 2003. And no one realized that error. In fact, on December 1st, 2003, the day before the trial, in pretrial hearings, the defense attorney even stated, I know the indictment charges from a time unknown to on or about March 5th, 2003. So I think we were all proceeding under the presumption or acting with the thought that the indictment still read from a time unknown until on or about March 5th, 2003. The defense attorney was also on notice of that, not only from the disclosure, which comes to me in waves. I wish that the second I opened the file, the case agent popped out and said, here's everything you're ever going to need on this case. But on these reactive cases, there's follow-up, there's new discovery, there's new disclosure, and as soon as I get it, I review it and I give it to defense counsel. The connection between the defendant and the person who rented the warehouse and the SUV, the traffic stop, January 3rd, 2003, didn't come until a week before trial. As a courtesy to defense counsel, I picked up the phone right away and I said, listen, this is going to be our intent. I don't have the reports yet, but the agent just told me that he's shown photo packs to various witnesses. They've got your guy in a car in January with the guy who rented the warehouse using an alias. I'll get those reports to you as soon as I can. November 27th was Thanksgiving. November 28th, I made the reports available. And defense counsel didn't pick them up until the Monday before trial. Co-defendant's attorney did pick up that disclosure on that Friday, the 28th. I did file a motion to continue the trial date, which I thought was a reasonable request. We had had a suppression hearing in October, which is when defense counsel was on notice that a guy named Sanchez rented the warehouse from Vakili. He was also on notice that that same white SUV, that Yukon Denali with the Georgia plates, was being operated, was a vehicle of interest. It was involved in another investigation in December and January of 2003. So he knew that the investigation was larger in scope. in October at the hearing.
So you moved for a continuance and the defense objected, so the court denied your motion?
Correct. We had that hearing in October. We didn't get a report and a recommendation from the magistrate until November. The magistrate judge had suppressed all my statements and a lot of my other evidence. I filed a timely objection to that November 24th. We were still waiting for a decision from that from the district court judge. And the district court judge decided that motion December 1st, rejected the report and recommendation, said my statements were back in, some of my other evidence was still out, some of the other evidence was in, and we're starting the trial tomorrow morning. So under those circumstances, I felt a little pressed, and I think we did the best that we could under those circumstances, but clearly there was no Fifth Amendment violation. There was no constructive amendment of the indictment. And I think what the court touched on earlier, on or about March 5th, 2003, it's certainly fluid. We're not talking about 4 or 5 years earlier. We're talking about 4 or 5 months earlier. And the net effect of what we did was very limited in scope. In November of 2002, a guy named Sanchez rented a warehouse. We were able to put that individual in a car driven by the defendant on January 3rd, 2003. That is the same vehicle that the defendant was driving on March 5th, 2003. And I'd like to now turn to the sufficiency of the evidence argument with regard to
Well, before you do that, if the purpose of the indictment is threefold, one of which is to protect from double jeopardy, another is to give the defendant notice of the charges that he's facing, and the third, I guess, is to allow him to raise a bar of statute of limitation, what would the limitation be in terms of how far back you could reach in the face of the indictment as it was framed? I mean, could you have gone back to show that 10 years before the defendant had met with the person who later rented the unit?
No, not when it's charged on or about March 5th, 2003. I think that would be reaching too far back. But I think that the 4 to 5 months
is okay.
I think that certainly puts them on notice, especially when the complaint and the first indictment charged from a time unknown, and as early, you know, in October, he was cross-examining a witness about this vehicle's connection to a larger investigation. He knew that that conspiracy, we weren't talking about just March 5th, 2003, that we were talking about other acts and events which occurred prior to that date. I'm not going to touch the second issue like defense counsel with regard to the 851 information. The defendant got actual notice of it in July, 5 months prior to trial. So unless there are questions on that, I'll turn to the sufficiency of the evidence. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, it's viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution. Any rational trier of fact could find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. All inferences are to be drawn in favor of the jury's verdict, and all conflicts also resolved in favor of the jury's verdict.
Counsel, believe me, we know what the law is on sufficiency of the evidence. If you want to argue the facts, go ahead.
Yes, please.
But I don't need a primer, and I don't think my colleagues do either.
Okay, I'm sorry. With regard to the conspiracy, there's clear evidence beyond reasonable doubt establishing a conspiracy. The warehouse was rented by an individual, Marcus Sanchez, using the alias Daniel Sanchez. He paid cash up front for a business called Interans Incorporated, which doesn't exist. His stated purpose was to run a produce distribution business. There was never any legal produce or produce whatsoever seen going in or out of that warehouse. Never saw any workers, box trucks, refrigerator trucks. The only thing one of the neighbors who rented a nearby warehouse, worked at a nearby warehouse, ever saw there were two vehicles, an Avalanche or an Escalade, and the other being the white Yukon Denali with the fancy rims and the Georgia plates, the same vehicle the defendant's driving January 3rd, 2003, same vehicle the defendant's driving on March 5th, 2003. From January to March of that year, five times he sees those two vehicles there. He smells a distinct odor he'd never smelled before. And on the stand, he was shown a bale of bulk marijuana. He smelled it and identified that smell as that same smell that he had never smelled before. We have those. On March 5th, 2003, we get a glimpse and we finally get inside the warehouse. There's 52 bales of marijuana, 843 pounds. It was not grown inside the warehouse, so it got there somehow, which, again, shows that there's other conspirators, other people acting and doing things. There's a sophisticated repackaging set up inside the warehouse. There's a scale. There's gloves. There's markers. There's spent cellophane and contact paper. 14 rolls of it, actually. And, in fact, it's the same exact contact paper that the defendant has on him when he's trying to enter the warehouse on March 5th, 2003. And the agents testified on their experience, almost every search warrant they've conducted, they've found that same contact paper and that stretch wrap. Marijuana or cocaine typically is wrapped in the stretch wrap first to keep it from drying out, and then it's wrapped in the contact paper to conceal its what's inside, to conceal its identity from people that were looking at it. And that's why they were doing these Home Depot operations, seeing who bought large amounts of this contact paper.
So we're staking out the pharmacies for people buying cold medication and Home Depot for people buying big rolls of plastic paper.
A contact paper.
Is there anything else I should be aware of?
Well, with six large rolls of contact paper, really the only legal reason to have contact, legal legitimate use of contact paper is to line shelves or to put it underneath sinks. With six large rolls, I think he had close to 700-800 square feet of it. That he could reline all the shelves in San Francisco. I think that it's fair for them to look at that and think there was something else going on. And they've actually been quite successful in Arizona with that operation. With regard to and the packaging inside the warehouse, it's important to note that the marijuana was wrapped in the cellophane and that stretch wrap, but hadn't gotten to the point where it was wrapped in that contact paper, the same contact paper that the defendant was bringing to the warehouse.
Counsel, would you briefly address, if you're successful, do you have any views as to what should be done about the sentencing in this case?
I do, Your Honor. I think I don't think it's a jury issue. Apprendi and Almendarez-Torres, dicta and Shepard aside, are still the law. But I do think – can I finish this question? Can I finish
the question? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But I do think that in light of the this Court's en banc decision in Ameline, that it would be appropriate to remand this matter for resentencing. I can't say that the district court judge, if he had known that the guidelines were advisory, would have given the same exact sentence. And it also would give us a chance to correct the supervised release portion of the
– Let me understand you. You are in favor of a remand for sentencing, not an Ameline remand to let the district court determine whether to resentence. There's a difference.
Okay.
You understand the distinction?
The Ameline –
In Ameline, we say we leave it up to the district court to determine whether – there should be a resentencing hearing. You're taking the position, now, if I understand you correctly, that you wish us to order a resentencing to take place.
Oh, no. I think it should be remanded. I think it's non-constitutional, potentially, error. I think that the district court judge, you know, it should be remanded and let him decide what he would do.
Whether he needs to resentence.
Whether he needs to resentence.
Okay. So you want a Crosby remand, essentially, under Ameline?
Yes.
All right. If I can use a shorthand. Counsel.
On the sufficiency of the evidence issue, what we have here is two connections that the prosecution was able to show between Daniel Sanchez and Mr. Villaseñor. The first is that they were in a vehicle together in January of 2003. The second is that Mr. Villaseñor is at this warehouse, which is securely locked with an industrial-type lock, and he there's absolutely no evidence at all that he is that Mr. Villaseñor was ever inside that warehouse or knew its contents. That is the sole extent of the evidence which the prosecution relies on.
Some evidence that Mr. Villaseñor was also jiggling the lock, trying to see if it was open.
There was some testimony that he tugged on the lock to see if it would open, and it wouldn't open. And in fact, there is evidence that when he was questioned by the officers, that he was asked whether he had a key. He stated, no, he did not. He provided the keys that he did have, and they were all tried. None of the keys that he had fit that lock. Basically, that's the evidence to show, one, a conspiracy with anybody, actually.
Well, wait a second. What about the Home Depot shopping?
What do you do with all the contact paper?
Yeah. I mean, well, this guy's loaded contact, roll after roll of this stuff.
Six rolls. And
contact paper.
It is a lot of contact paper, but whether or not he knew what Mr. Sanchez intended to do with it, if in fact it was for Mr. Sanchez, of which there is no evidence, but if in fact that's the case, how does the fact that somebody buys six rolls of contact paper make them a knowing participant in this conspiracy?
Can't
which is charged
the
indictment?
Can't the jury look at what the agents found inside the premises where your client was trying to gain entry and link the contact paper that he bought at the Home Depot with its use as packaging material inside that premises?
If there was some evidence that he knew what was inside, yes. But as he testified, or as he stated to the agents, and what they testified to was, somebody, a friend of his, asked him to pick up the contact paper and drop it off at the warehouse. That's the evidence.
What do you do with the neighbor's sighting of the white Denali with Georgia plates on five different occasions at the warehouse?
He sees the vehicle. There's absolutely no evidence that he sees Mr. Villaseñor there. And, in fact, the evidence is that that vehicle was seen at Mario Jacobo's house by Agent Tillis, who was doing that investigation. But that's the first time, well, that's the first time that Mr. Villaseñor is seen in that vehicle apart from the January incident. But that's basically what the evidence is to sustain this conviction for a conspiracy to possess this large quantity of marijuana. Okay. We submit it's insufficient.
Very well. Thank you. The case just argued is submitted. And we will next hear.